Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, I'm your host, Dr. Carl Rhodes. Today's show is examining whether Australia can trust the United States to deliver deterrence as part of our alliance. So this is part of our NIDS Knowledge Deterrence Down Under series. And today I have guests Dr. Christine Lee, NIDS Fellow, and Natalie Treylor from India Alpha Consulting joining me from Canberra. I've also got Justin Anderson, who's a Senior Policy Fellow at the U.S. National Deterrence University Center for Study of WMD, joining from the other side of the Pacific, although he's probably on the Atlantic side of the United States, I'm guessing, but he's still on the other side of the Pacific from us. Just a disclaimer as we get started here that the views of the host and all of our guests are our own and don't represent any institution that we may be affiliated with. So today we're going to talk about a few topics related to, can the U.S. really be trusted to deliver deterrence here to Australia? The Virginia-class subs, specifically as an example of acquisition program and as a partner in the region. So I think there are a couple of issues that have come up over time. Some have come up even before AUKUS was in place. There's been some long-term concerns by some in the community about, you know, can the U.S. really be trusted in the long term? And one of the big critics has been Hugh White, who says, you know, well, I don't know if we can really trust the United States. And he put out a longer article. So maybe, Natalie, would you like to comment and say, you know, some of his concerns from the long term? And then we'll go to Christine on that topic as well.
So some of Hugh White's concerns was that AUKUS isn't really, like, and I quote him, it's not really about submarines for Australia. He sees this being more about the US and Australia's ability to, or allegiance with the US alliance as well, and that the US needs to lock that in with us.
Christine, how about you? You've worked with Hugh White over time. What are your thoughts in terms of his views?
Yeah, look, mate, Hugh White, he was one of my PhD supervisors, so I'm a little bit biased here. I don't agree with everything he says, but I think he's pretty smart, and I think he is a good source of quote-unquote controversy down here. There's not enough debate about, you know, what the Australian government's committing to, so I found this piece quite good, quite scathing, but I would tend to agree with a lot of the points he's raised. It seems to be about locking Australia into a long-term plan in the Pacific, but it's not clear, at least to me, how committed the US is long-term to extended deterrence in the Asia-Pacific. And it's not clear that the US actually wants to do nuclear strategy again. Like, there was a comment, Biden was saying, you know, we recently that we live in one of the most dangerous times in the since before the onset of the Second World War. And look at how much the United States committed to trying to mobilize industrially in terms of its troops and so forth. We're not seeing, if that's the case, if we are in such a dangerous time, what's the US doing? Like, in terms of, again, industrial base, you know, forward deploying troops for, you know, to create sort of tripwires, conventional and nuclear ones in the region. I'm not seeing a lot of action, so I'm like, well, you know, I personally love Americans, you know, I live there, I studied from the best, but like, in terms of like security commitments, I've yet to be convinced.
Yeah, exactly. The United States has a lot of commitments, obviously, and the Indo-Pacific is one of many where, even though there's a lot of, I would say, regional tension, there hasn't been much hot action as compared to, say, Russia-Ukraine or, you know, what's happening in Israel, where the United States has had to focus more, as well as with the Red Sea. Justin, how about your view? How has AUKUS changed, you know, the U.S. view of thinking about the alliance with Australia and regional commitments?
Thanks, Carl, and I hope I'm coming through loud and clear now. It's very nice to be on the program. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with all of you on this important topic. So I think I would say a couple things at the outset. One is that, you know, AUKUS itself is a significant and long-term strategic commitment by the United States. And while the focus is often on the nuclear-powered submarines, which is understandable, of course, it is broader than that. And, you know, some of the aspects that have gone a little less reported, but I think are quite important, are what is going on in Northern Australia with regards to air power and U.S. and Australian air power, you know, being, I think, integrated and having a new approach to the way we think about Australia as a key ally within the region. I wouldn't say this is a radical difference because we have a close and enduring alliance, but, you know, it makes a difference. If a B-52, you know, shows up and shows up regularly and is operating with, you know, fighter and support aircraft of your state, that is a U.S. nuclear-capable strategic asset, and it is a big deal when it shows up to allies and adversaries alike. So there are certainly many challenges within the Indo-Pacific, and I think there are lots of questions that should always be asked in terms of, are we adapting to those challenges? And that's a, you know, a constant thing that we have to think about. But I think that the commitment is real, is enduring. And, you know, frankly, I think the importance of the Indo-Pacific isn't going to go away. You know, while one administration to another may look at the Indo-Pacific a little bit differently and have a different approach to the challenges there, the fact of the matter is the U.S., as, you know, as past presidents have said, is itself a Pacific power. I'm from the West Coast of the United States, and I think it's, you know, important to understand the U.S. looks outward, both west and east, and is a global power whose commitments are to a number of different regions, but whose military power can transition, you know, pretty quickly in a way that is strategically important and taken on board by adversaries, you know, with the capabilities that we do have.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, which is, you know, the U.S. is a global power and has global commitments and has the ability to move forces. But, you know, the concern here may be that, you know, there hasn't been enough focus placed on, you know, China as a threat and enough focus placed and forces, you know, moved to deal with that threat. And that could erode deterrence because of other commitments around the world. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, you know, in terms of the U.S. prioritization?
Yeah, well, Carl, I don't think it'll be news to anyone on this pod that, you know, U.S. presidents often come in and, you know, want to, you know, focus on one issue area or one set of challenges. And both the virtue and also the challenge of being a global superpower is other, you know, there's going to be brush fires. There's going to be things that crop up elsewhere. And you're probably going to have to respond in real time to, you know, the challenges where they're at. And that's not something that you can necessarily always plan for in advance. So that's just part of the responsibility that the U.S. takes on board in having allies and partners around the world. But of course, we also see all those relationships as part of how we can together be resilient to face key challenges. I think that the challenge posed by China, of course, is a military one. And that's why the Department of Defense says that China is a pacing threat. And the way we think about China as that challenge is, you know, to try to think in the long term. Again, which is why AUKUS isn't a this year or next year. It is a generational commitment. And that has to be the way that we think about the China challenge. But I think that we also, and you've seen this from the Secretary of Defense and other officials in this administration, talking about trying to have a better integrated deterrent. And I think that Australia especially is well aware of all the different ways that a country like China can attempt to coerce it. And integrated deterrence is not a new concept. It is a challenge to develop and implement, for sure. You also have to be careful that it can be applied to a lot of different things. So we want to be focused in how it's applied. But I think what is important to communicate there is that it's not just about military capability. Absolutely, military capability is a part of it. But the challenge we face is one that is military, it's diplomatic, it's economic. And that means trying to bring a lot of resources and assets together, U.S. allied partner, to address, indeed, the generational challenge that I think China poses to us and all democracies.
Fantastic. That's a good review. I was going to say, Christine, I saw you cringe when the word integrated deterrence came up, or two words.
Yep.
Would you like to comment on integrated deterrence and your thoughts as an Australian strategist on this?
Thank you. Yeah, look, no, Justin, I'm going to call BS on integrated deterrence. I know we like to come up with new concepts, but like, it's not a new concept. Like, it's just government doing stuff. And personally, I think it's like an excuse to not have to talk about the nuclear issues. We did integrated deterrence during the Cold War. Integrated deterrence is just grand strategy. Like, it's just an excuse as a new concept, but it's not. Like, we did integrated deterrence during the Cold War. We use all the economic, you know, all the different levers to try and deter the Soviet Union and reassure European allies. What I'm not seeing in the Asia Pacific today is those conversations around the threatening to use nuclear weapons. Like, we're not having those discussions like counterforce, countervalue, you know, escalation dominance. Where are the discussions happening around those concepts, you know, the hard concepts of nuclear strategy, of nuclear deterrence, of deterrence in general, like the conventional nuclear nexus? I'm not seeing it.
Christine, how much do you think that that relates back to how transparent Australia is on its on what those challenges are? Like, for example, you know, Hugh White says the extraordinary challenges that that Australia faces. But when we read the 2023 Defence Strategic Review, it mentions nuclear several times in relation to nuclear-powered submarines. However, it only mentions the prospects of Australia facing nuclear Armageddon during the Cold War. Whereas this is in stark contrast to the threats identified in the US documents, such as the unclassified versions of the 2024 Annual Threat Assessment of the US Intelligence Community, the 2022 National Defense Strategy, and the hearings of the US Senate Committee on Armed Services. To me, like, these documents, the US documents, illustrate the fact that, you know, we're not in Kansas City anymore, Toto.
I was in Kansas City last year. It's a very nice place. I mean, like I said, I think it's interesting, like, Australia has an interesting history here because we were involved in the Cold War through Pine Gap, the joint facilities. We were contributing to deterrence in that sense, you know, relaying from CONUS to, you know, US attack submarines in the Pacific. We thought of the Cold War as this global construct, and it was, because it impacted directly, indirectly, you know, all parts of the world in different ways. But I think I was thinking about this the other day for a research proposal. Like, I think now, truly, with the advent of China as a significant military threat, it is truly a global competition for influence. And the difference is that the US doesn't just have to deal with the Soviet Union, it now also has to deal with China. So how do you think about deterrence in a tripolar superpower situation, which, you know, is kind of unprecedented in history? I mean, we've had, you know, China, India, Pakistan, but they weren't superpowers as such. But like, how do we think about deterrence concepts in this tripolar situation? And I think it's much more relevant now to Australia because the Asia Pacific is, I don't want to say the front line, but it's, you know, it's the strategic center of gravity in the world has now shifted to Asia in quite a significant way. So, and I think Australia is not used to being, you know, kind of in the middle of great power competition in such a direct manner. And I think there's just some uncomfortableness about that, and we're not, quite mature enough to be having those conversations, but we should be. Justin, thoughts?
Yeah, thanks. And I'd also like to briefly respond to your earlier comment. One is to say that I actually think the discussion about the sometimes complex relationship of conventional and nuclear deterrence actually has changed and matured in part because, frankly, of the last 2 years and Russia's war on Ukraine and some of the issues that has brought forward, and as well as the evolving nuclear threat in the Indo-Pacific, which has us, engaging with allies like South Korea in a closer way on a number of these related issues. So I think those discussions are taking place. Now, they may be taking place at a different sort of pace and different level across, different allies, perhaps. But I think that they are taking place. I won't say that they aren't difficult and challenging, because these issues are just inherently difficult and challenging. But I do think that they're happening in a way that, in the course of my work on nuclear issues, is actually different, and I think is more sophisticated and more challenging for all of us. But I do think that they are happening. Maybe not all, maybe sometimes a bit below the surface, but they are happening. And then I think the other thing I would say is, I understand the response to integrated deterrence. I've heard that from others too. I think that I like the term, not because I think it's new. You're right, it isn't. But just because I think the salience of for example, having to look at an action that China or Russia is taking, say, somewhere in the world. And we need to have a coordinated, not just defense response, but you have to think, okay, what are they going to be doing at the United Nations? What are they going to be doing within a forum like an NPT RevCon or a BWC RevCon? What are they going to be doing economically? Or are there ways we can push back against them economically? So the way in which we have to do all at the same time, you can absolutely argue that we were doing the same in the Cold War to a degree, but I think just the pace of how things move, it being so much faster and just having to, integrate at a faster and sort of more multidimensional way, I do think that's new. So we want to be careful to not say this is entirely brand new, but I do think it changes some of the ways in which the United States and important allies like Australia have to think about working together, both inside their own governments and together as allies, in a way that I think does require a sort of new level of sophistication and coordination. And I think there's general agreement in that. And so then the question is, okay, how do we do that? And that is something that we're working through in real time.
Yeah, I think one of the big challenges is there's a multipolar target of deterrence. It's no longer one specific adversary like the Soviet Union. It is China, it is Russia, it is those rogue powers that are developing nuclear weapons. And here in Australia, with the Defense Strategic Review released, was it 2 years ago now? I can't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago. Last year, I think it was. Australia's come out with a strategy saying that they want to deter by denial. They don't really call out China as being the target of that deterrence, but it's pretty clear it is. So you've got Australia, a conventional power, and a sizable one, although not a world power like China, without nuclear weapons, trying to deter a nuclear power. And I think that's a real challenge here, and how thinking about integration with the United States, as the United States is rotating forces, as the United States is rotating potentially nuclear-capable forces, like the buffs we talked about coming to the north, how does Australia really address that challenge, right? I mean, that's the real challenge, is this extended deterrence match that Australia needs as part of deterrence, but also being a conventional deterrent power. So, Christine or Natalie, I don't know if either of you want to jump in on that. Maybe Christine, her eyes look widest.
Yeah, I think from an international relations theory perspective, it's quite interesting, the whole the contribution that nuclear weapons make to an alliance, right? So this reminds me of the debates that happened in the 1980s around the joint facilities, Pine Gap and New Zealand and ANZUS. So one of my PhD supervisors, Des Ball, he wrote a book, A Suitable Piece of Real Estate, kind of uncovering, you know, the role of Pine Gap and so forth. And it sparked a big debate in Australia and New Zealand about the extent to which Australia contributes to quote-unquote nuclear war fighting versus nuclear deterrence, which are, you know, part of the same kind of, part of the same spectrum. And it then, at roughly about the same time, there was a debate in New Zealand because controversy around nuclear-armed submarines passing through New Zealand waters. And there's a very good debate by the Prime Minister of the time, Lang, I can't remember the name of the book. Anyway, but there was a debate about New Zealand wants the alliance, but they don't want the nuclear aspect of the alliance. And the Australian government was saying, well, no, we can't pick and choose what we want in the alliance. It is by default a nuclear alliance. You can't just get rid of the nuclear aspect. So that New Zealand got kicked out of ANZUS. But it's an interesting question. Like, to what extent is Australia comfortable with the nuclear aspect of the alliance? And I suspect it'll be a case of don't ask, don't tell. But Natalie, if you got thoughts.
So some of my thoughts on that one are just some of the conversations that we have, like in the general public and with maybe some of the military people that we work with as well, is that the nuclear aspects, we haven't really had to think about these for a long time. Yep. If ever, and it really doesn't, it sort of comes back down to that article or the DIB review, the 1981 DIB report, where it talks about the threat that Australia faced in the Cold War. And I don't know how comfortable we are with this new reality that we face. And I think part of that comes back down to how well we articulate that in our documents too. And the discussions that we have with the Australian public. But a lot of people are uncomfortable with either the thought of nuclear deterrence and or nuclear weapons. And I think Australia needs to become more comfortable with that conversation.
Yeah.
So talking about military capability, and part of the reason why I think we came up with this topic was, you know, a shorter-term issue, which is details of Biden's proposed 25 defense budget came out, and there was only one Virginia-class sub in that budget, and there's been a lot of talk that Congress approved the transfer of Virginia-class subs in the future to Australia based on the assumption that, you know, the production rate would increase to 2.3 or so, you know. So this raises the question of, will the U.S. really deliver on their promise of showing up with Virginia-class subs based on, you know, there's the official comments and then there's what others have said. So, you know, Justin, I don't know if you've seen any of this discussion in the U.S. I know there's concern about the defense budget and some of the numbers in it.
Sure. I mean, I'm in Washington, so we get to live this in real time. And I think what I would just emphasize is that, you know, to repeat a point that this administration, but previous administrations have made too, which is so long as we continue to just have continuing resolutions as a frequent approach to addressing, you know, larger budget and policy issues, it makes large capital programs of all types just difficult to plan, more challenging to implement. And it is something that I very much hope, you know, both parties are able to work through into the future, because it is, I think, a challenge for any large program. You know, that we look, programs need regular budgets. They need to know what they can count for and how to outlay. And especially if it's a complex program, you know, that's just something that's necessary for meeting timelines. And so I just, you know, I think I would just observe that that's something I think we all would hope for, that into the future, this is something that is just, you know, less of a challenge. The reality is that, you know, the political divisions being what they are, it's just something that I hope that we work through. I mean, I think Congress was able to pass important legislation back in December, very important to AUKUS. So I think this is something that's absolutely possible. Is it challenging? Sure. That's just a reality we're going to have to deal with. I wonder if I could briefly also respond to something that Natalie and Christine had said, which is just to underline that, you know, I think it is not possible now and into the future to try to pull nuclear stuff or extended deterrence or other things out of, you know, an alliance relationship or how allies have to deal with complex threats. You know, the unfortunate reality we all face is that countries like Russia and North Korea, you know, are going to rattle the nuclear saber and do so in a way that is fundamentally different in the past. And that I think all democracies have to face a reality that, you know, autocracies armed with nuclear weapons will turn to them for the purposes of coercion in various and challenging ways. So this idea that you can somehow separate out things nuclear, and look, I understand nuclear weapons, I don't think they should be feared, but they have to be respected. And I understand that it can often be challenging within polities, but we have to talk about them. There is no way to confront these threats without this realization that nuclear weapons, whether used for the purposes of coercion or in other ways, are just something that we're going to have to respond to. And it's of a piece of how the alliance pushes back against these you know, autocratic threats.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Yeah, I would say the one thing that is a bit foreign here, here in Australia, is this idea that defense is politicized and held hostage by politics. Because here in Australia, there's often bipartisan agreement on the large issues related to defense and, you know, the continuation of programs across, you know, different parties as they come in. There are slight differences and sometimes some changes that are made, but, you know, usually there's continuation as compared to the United States where things are held up. I would say the other thing that's been interesting is, you know, the United States, Virginia class, I think Australia was counting on, you know, continuity and ease of build and on budget, on time delivery. Part of the reason why Australia got out of the program with the French was because problems with the program. And so I think there's a bit of surprise here as well about, you know, why can't the U.S. do this? They've been doing this forever. But just like every country runs into programs in terms of large programs, large military programs, with budgets that go over and timelines that extend. So Natalie, maybe your thoughts on that. You know, do you think there's, you know, been a surprise here, and what would happen if, you know, Pillar One failed for Australia?
I definitely think it would be a bad thing if AUKUS does fail, and that we don't get the submarines. It also I don't think would look good for our alliance with the US either. But you know, I think it was back in 2008, the Rand Corporation did a review of the UK MOD's submarine construction capacity, and they even said back then that they should be looking to their allies, for such as potentially Australia and the US, to increase that capacity. So we shouldn't be surprised by this conversation. Yeah, I think there is a real need to build out this industrial capacity that Robert Peters and Wilson Beavis talk about in their AUKUS is a good step, but it needs to go further. And that includes AUKUS Pillar 2 as well as the technology sharing. I think that in these challenging pacing times, the only way to sort of outpace that is going to be by sharing knowledge. I understand there's many challenges with that, but it has its own, it can come with its own problems, but I do think that in the long run, they are going to be things that we need as well.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Natalie. Thanks for that great summary. So back to our big question. I'll have Christine and Justin both take a swing at that as we close up here. The big question is, can the U.S. be trusted in this alliance? So, Christine, you know, closing thoughts.
Yeah, look, I mean, like I said, I love Americans. But I... compared to Western Europe during the Cold War, like, deterrence was relatively easy to, quote-unquote, operationalize. You know, you deploy troops, you deploy conventional troops on European soil. You have, you know, it's a land-based alliance, mainly. Everyone's facing the same threat. Everyone has the same, relatively same threat perceptions and so forth. But in the Asia Pacific, it's quite different. It's essentially a maritime context. So what are the logistical challenges of that? Like, you know, fuel, resupply of ammunition and so forth. It's a hubs and spokes alliance system. So we don't have, you know, a la NATO. Japan, South Korea and Australia aren't allies as such. Not that they necessarily need to be. But it's interesting balancing the different countries' threat perceptions and how do we have a common understanding, a common operating picture of you know, the China threat? How do we work together to deter? How do we think together in terms of, you know, concepts of operations, also escalation ladders? What's escalatory and what's not? You know, there are some war games, I won't name which ones, but like, South Koreans and the Japanese have very different thinking around what's escalatory and what's not. Like, for example, like what does NEO stand for again?
Non-combatant evacuation.
Thank you. You know, the South Koreans say that, oh, no, please don't evacuate the citizens. The North Koreans will think we're about to hit them. You know, it's and Australia's like, well, they're your citizens, so what gives? But I think that's all these discussions need to be had if we're going to have, you know, sort of, as Justin says, integrated deterrence. Yeah.
I think that's a good summary of the view from one of the spokes here of that deterrence. Now we'll go to Justin, who's sitting at the hub with his ear to the ground there.
Australia can rely upon the United States. And that's a reflection of the long history of this alliance and fighting through some, you know, pretty challenging circumstances and some pretty challenging wars. And I think something that's important for emphasis here from those who, you know, have worked alliance issues, you know, longer than I have, is to say that certainly there are always contemporary challenges, but this is a robust alliance. I mean, Australia is a member of the Five Eyes. Australia and the United States at, you know, the military and the policy level work together really well and really closely in a way that I think is actually the envy of some other alliances. So I think that it is a close, tight, and enduring alliance. And also, I think the U.S. is in for the long haul, because we have to be. We have to address the challenge posed by China. We have to be an important player in the Indo-Pacific. And those things aren't going to change. So I believe that, in summary, Australia can count on the United States, and the United States is also counting on Australia for a lot of big and important things now and into the future.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks a lot, Justin, for that excellent summary. Thanks, Natalie. Thanks, Christine. A really good discussion of the alliance and the state of it, and, you know, asking the kind of rhetorical question, can the U.S. be trusted? But let's face it, the U.S. has been here for Australia many times in the past, as has Australia for the United States. So with that, we'll wrap it up for NIDS Down Under. Thanks, everyone, and have a great day. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.